This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Give up hope and exit out of environmentalism? In the UK, deep greener Paul Kingsnorth says he's leaving the climate movement, which is lost anyway.
And also coming to the conclusion, and it was a very difficult conclusion to admit to myself, but I think a lot of people are starting to admit it to themselves now, coming to the conclusion that a lot of the problems that we're facing can't be solved in the sense that we would like to solve them. For example, we're not going to stop climate changing. We're not going to stop the mass extinction event that we're in at the moment. Hopefully we can prevent it from getting any worse than it has to get, but we're in it and it's happening and it's too late to do a lot of things about it.
Who else is on their way out the door? This week we'll hear a challenging interview with one of the co-founders of Greenpeace International, Michael McGonigal. He's been battling since the late 1960s. He teaches environmental law at the University of Victoria in Canada. Two hosts from the podcast, The Extra Environmentalist, interview Michael for Radio EcoShock about his new strategy, which he calls Exit Environmentalism. Just in case, we'll top that off with a shot at techno-optimism as well. But first, I'll talk with chemical engineer and biofuels specialist Robert Rapier. We go to the fundamentals of the energy crisis, peak oil, Asian demand, speculation, and all that. Rapier compares greenhouse gas emissions from Asia to an unstoppable hurricane. I don't agree with everything all our guests say, but Robert takes me closer to exit environmentalism with his clear, cold logic about the real world we live in. Brain stimulation from Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. How realistic are biofuels as a replacement for oil? And are we headed for energy independence or an energy crash? Robert Rapier would know. He's got 20 years' experience as a chemical engineer working with all kinds of fuels. Currently, Robert is Chief Technology Officer at Merica International, a renewables and forestry company based in Hawaii. Rapier is also Managing Editor of Consumer Energy Report and a regular guest on mainstream media. His latest book is Power Plays, Energy Options in the Age of Peak Oil. Robert, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to this energy crisis, and that's mostly what we're going to talk about, I was intrigued by your position on climate change. As an energy industry guy, your book compares greenhouse gas emissions to an unstoppable hurricane. Tell us about that.
I think we in the West tend to think that the United States and Canada, to a lesser extent, but our per capita emissions are indeed very high. And so we tend to think that we are the major problem. But if you look at global emissions, our emissions in the U.S. and Canada, in the EU, so in North America and the EU, have declined over the past 10 years. And at the same time, emissions in Asia Pacific are skyrocketing. Now, they're already higher than ours, which people don't realize that. Our per capita emissions are higher, but they have so many more people. And so when you think about how exactly we're going to address that, you know, we focus on our emissions here in the West, but if you looked, if the United States completely fell off the map, our emissions would only go back to like 1994 levels, and they would still be rapidly climbing. So we're largely focused, I think, on the wrong target. I mean, true, we need to do something about our own emissions. We need to try to set an example, but we use 10 times the oil that, say, China does per person. So we lack the moral authority. We lack the technology to show them how to develop without fossil fuels. And so it's a very difficult situation where they're coming up from a very low standard of living using just a little bit of oil, but already the little bit of oil by a whole lot of people has dwarfed our emissions and is still rapidly climbing. So it's hard to see how we get a handle on that.
And you've called the whole discussion about climate change academic, that's your phrase. You seem to be saying we should just suck it up and try to adapt. Is that your stance? And if so, are you getting flack for that?
I do get some flack for it. It's not exactly my stance. My stance is not that we should just suck it up. What I'm trying to do is project the future. And when I project the future, I say, here's what's likely to happen. What's likely to happen is we will continue, our emissions will probably continue to decline somewhat from here, but Asia Pacific's emissions are going to continue to climb unabated. I mean, it's not only Asia Pacific. Africa, the Middle East, South America, all these regions of the world, all these developing regions are rapidly increasing their fossil fuel consumption. And so I say it becomes academic because while we debate how we're going to get our emissions down, the emissions just continue to climb. And the reason I liken it to a hurricane, you know, we can talk about whether climate change is going to be really bad and disastrous and so forth, just like when we watched Hurricane Katrina come in. You know, the night before it came in, I told my wife, I said, I'm afraid this is going to destroy New Orleans. But one thing we didn't talk about is, well, how do you stop the hurricane? And that's what I see in Asia Pacific right now. The reason I say it's academic, I don't see a viable way to stop them from increasing their fossil fuel consumption because they're already at such a low level per capita. So I've likened it to a rich person trying to tell a poor person how to live within their means. You know, the poor person is just trying to scratch out a living and increase their standard of living, while the rich person has already done that. We've already increased our emissions from a very low level, and we've gotten to a high level per person. We just don't have nearly as many people as they do. So it's hard to see. I mean, the technology does not exist. No country has developed to a high level of development without fossil fuels. So to imagine that it can be done, we're imagining something that's never been done before.
Well, I agree with you generally, but I do have two points of hope. One is the pollution there is terrible, the air pollution, and I think eventually people will ask for a cleanup just to get their health better, and alternative fuels or even solar energy might help with that. And then we'll get to our main topic of discussion here, the peak oil. Perhaps the fossil fuels will be limited, and so the emissions won't go up and up forever. And one question that comes to me from some listeners, do you think Asian demand for fossil fuels is one of the reasons why North American gasoline prices are going up?
That is the single biggest reason North American gasoline prices are going up. I mean, people ask me that, and I tell them, you know, if you want to know why, look east, look to Asia, look to China. Their increase in demand over the past 10 years, I mean, their oil consumption has nearly doubled in the past decade, and it shows no signs of slowing down. That has taken all the excess capacity, or nearly all of the excess capacity of oil production out. They've consumed it all. And so that has led to a great deal of volatility, and it's led to much higher prices. That is the single biggest reason. But, of course, the fact that we consume a lot, I mean, there's another part there, and the United States consumes an awful lot of oil. So both the parts together are what's driven prices so high. Prices climbed so quickly because they increased their demand so quickly, but they came from a somewhat higher level because we used so much in the first place.
I'm wondering, though, what about the role of oil speculators?
There is a role of oil speculators, but people often attribute, I think, too much of this to oil speculators. I mean, consider the same speculators are speculating in natural gas, and natural gas are at 10-year lows. Why is that? Because the underlying fundamentals support that price. And so with the oil speculators, if there weren't underlying fundamentals supporting that speculation, they could never drive the price up there and hold it there.
Robert Rapier, in your career as a chemical engineer, you've worked with a lot of different biofuels. What are the most promising bioenergy sources with the least ecological damage?
Well, there's always trade-offs, and that was, I talk about that a lot, that corn ethanol, for instance. Corn ethanol is definitely making a contribution to our energy. At the same time, people argue that it's driven food prices up. It's caused ecological damage as fertilizers and pesticides have run off into the Mississippi River and ended up in the Gulf of Mexico. So every single case, we have a situation where we have to evaluate the trade-offs. You know, we have palm oil. Palm oil is a very good fuel. It makes a very good jet fuel. And yet, we're clearing rainforest to put in palm oil plantations. The real hope is algae, and that's still a long ways off. But algae would be ideal because you could grow it on non-arable land and produce fuel that way. And technically, it can be done, but the price is still up there pretty high.
And one of the bottom line questions is, could we really produce enough biofuels to replace fossil fuels?
And the answer to that is no. We will not produce enough biofuels to replace oil. The 85 million barrels a day of oil we produce, realistically, if I look out, I'd say we may replace 10, if in the most optimistic scenario, we could replace 20% of that with biofuels before we really get into some serious land use issues and really start cutting down on our ability to grow food for the population.
And what is the difference between methanol and ethanol, and is one of them a better fuel?
Methanol is the simplest alcohol. It has one carbon. Ethanol has two carbons. Both of them function very well as fuels. They both have similar disadvantages toward gasoline. Both of them have lower energy content per gallon. So methanol is about half the energy content of gasoline. Ethanol is about two-thirds. They're both more corrosive than gasoline. So ethanol is more corrosive than gasoline. Methanol is more corrosive than ethanol. But there's been a lot of testing done on both fuels. Methanol has traded cheaper than the price of gasoline for many years. It's normally made from natural gas, but it's a major, it's one of the world's largest commodity chemicals. It's very easy to produce. We can produce it from natural gas. We can produce it from wood, but it has never enjoyed the kind of political support that ethanol has enjoyed, because ethanol has the farm lobby in the U.S., and that is a very powerful interest group, and they've managed to get legislation passed that really favored ethanol. Methanol had the upper hand 2 decades ago. California, for instance, had a program where they produced and tested methanol on a pretty large scale. They just never built out sufficient infrastructure. But methanol, for a car that's compatible with it, remains a very good and promising fuel.
And talking about the politics of all this, you have also warned that U.S. taxpayers are subsidizing fuel for Europeans. How could that happen?
Yeah, that is true. That's some traders in Europe brought that up last year. They brought up the fact that ethanol that's being subsidized in the U.S. with tax credits is being blended into gasoline and then shipped over to Europe. So the tax credit is being collected in the U.S., and then so it's subsidized as it's going to Europe. And the Europeans have been protesting this. Now, it's not happening anymore because that tax credit expired at the end of the year. And the ethanol industry denied it. But at the same time, they've denied it. You will see that ethanol exports have plummeted. So following the expiration of that tax credit, and I said that then. I wrote about this a year ago. And I said, well, we'll know when the tax credit expires. If the exports fall, then they probably were benefiting from the tax credit, and they have indeed plummeted.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with alternative energy expert Robert Rapier. We've heard big claims lately that North America is an emerging energy giant once again with trillions of barrels of reserves. What are they talking about, Robert, and where the heck is it?
Well, when they talk about trillions of barrels, what they're really talking about is oil shale out in the Green River Formation in Utah, Colorado, and Wyoming. And this oil shale is, it looks like a rock. I mean, you could mistake it for coal. It is essentially oil that Mother Nature didn't finish cooking. So it never got hot enough. It never got enough pressure. And so to process it into oil, you actually have to dig it up, and or there are some processes that actually heat it in the ground, but you have to cook it. And that there's the rub. You have to add energy to it in order to get it to convert it into oil. And so the reserve of that is actually zero. The reserve would be what can economically be produced. And today, that number is zero. The resource is huge. But the difference in a resource and a reserve, I sometimes explain to people by talking about the dissolved gold in the oceans. There's trillions of dollars of gold in the oceans. And so that would be the resource. We have an enormous resource of gold in the oceans, but the reserve, what could be economically produced, is zero. You cannot economically produce that gold in the oceans.
You know, after that Keystone Pipeline permit was denied in the U.S., the Canadian government and a big Texas energy company, Kinder Morgan, are plotting to ship that unrefined tar sands product to China and other Asian countries, and they're going to use West Coast Canadian ports. And we've seen big Chinese oil companies putting billions into the tar sands. I'm wondering, is it possible we could see an energy future where North Americans are almost starved for oil, even though it's produced here?
You know, I think Canada's moves make complete sense. And from Canada's perspective, they don't want to be completely reliant on the U.S. market, because our politics are such that, that they change every couple of years, and you just can't have consistency. China, you know, you're going to have continuing growing demand from China. So from Canada's perspective, it makes sense to go that direction. It is possible, and one of my biggest fears, and people sometimes misunderstand my position, because I support the Keystone Pipeline, and at the same time I support renewable energy, and people say, how can you support both? And I say, because we're going to have to transition. We're going to have to transition from oil to alternative energy. But during that transition, of course, we're still going to require oil. And one of the worst things that can happen is that we try to transition too quickly and we shift away from oil. We don't develop our oil and the alternatives are not there. And so what happens in that case is indeed we could be starved for energy and see skyrocketing energy prices. The flip side, though, is I've always said we're not going to drill our way to energy independence. We simply don't have the oil. We now have a contingency plan there where we are trying to move to alternatives as rapidly as possible, but we have got the insurance policy there of things like the Keystone Pipeline if that transition doesn't happen quickly enough, if the alternatives don't deliver.
I've got to wonder, though, will we really make the transition unless we're forced to? We like the easy oil lifestyle.
We do like it. I mean, we there's a love-hate relationship because we hate the pollution. We hate to see oil-covered birds, but then we also hate to pay higher prices for oil. And historically, the only thing that really impacts us is paying more for oil. I've made some proposals that would actually have us paying more for oil but paying less on other taxes so that it would essentially be a shift in our tax burden from income over into oil. That would speed up a transition. And those are the kinds of things. You're absolutely right. We vote with our pocketbooks. We consume less oil when the price goes up. And so our demand has fallen over the past couple of years on the back of much, much higher oil prices. Ironically, and you might not think this, and I wouldn't have guessed this, I would have guessed that as oil prices went up, the developing countries would be priced out of the oil market. That has not happened. Their demand has grown unabated. And this is why when I started to become skeptical that we would positively address climate change. And when you think about why that is, it finally occurred to me why it is. In the West, we consume 22 barrels of oil per person per year. In China, they consume 2. And so that second barrel of oil to them is worth more than $100. I mean, they would probably pay $200 or $300 if they could just hold on to the 2 barrels they consume. For us, the 22nd barrel is allowing us to drive the 12,000th mile a year. And so we make some small changes, and we cut back a little bit, and so we're able to cut our discretionary demand. Theirs is more a matter of life and death and very basic necessities. And in that case, you can see that they can continue to grow their demand even though prices are much higher because it's just simply buying them things that they've never had before that we take for granted.
Robert Rapier, your new book is Power Plays, Energy Options in the Age of Peak Oil. What choices do you recommend in the book?
I talk about a lot of things. I try to get people to think about energy in a different way and to think about things they haven't thought about before. You know, we're familiar with the oil-covered birds, but there's also, the wind farms are slicing up, golden eagles and protected species. And that's not to say we shouldn't develop wind farms because, cars also kill birds. So we make those kinds of trade-offs. But I want to be sure people understand the trade-offs. What are the trade-offs from nuclear power? What does it mean to phase out nuclear power? I get into a lot of background information on who uses oil, who uses coal, what the impacts are and what the real trade-offs are that many times are made behind the scenes without our express consent. And then I get into a lot of what are some of the alternatives, how might we move away from oil, and then some specific recommendations such as the tax scheme where we could, taxes, oil taxes are in the U.S., fossil fuel taxes are something that politicians won't touch. But if you put it in a way that said, look, the average person's tax burden is not going to increase at all. It's just that you're going to pay more for gasoline and less for, your income. And the benefit is going to be your kids will have gasoline where they may have very little gasoline now. So if you frame it as an issue like that, where it's going to benefit future generations, it might be able to be sold. I mean, it's still going to be a difficult sell, but I think the only way you could sell it is to say it's going to be revenue neutral. But in fact, if people make changes, they can actually decrease the amount of taxes they pay because this is much more voluntary. If we shift taxes and we say we're going to give you a tax credit based on the amount of gasoline the average family uses, well, you can cut back your gasoline consumption and suddenly you're paying less taxes. So there's an appeal there. I've also put together a proposal that says, we need to explore and we need to develop our domestic resources, But at the same time, we need to target that money into programs that decrease our dependence on oil. So, you know, I would be selling leases. I would definitely put it in there, put the contract in such a way that if oil prices spike, that the government gets an increasing portion of those revenues. So the windfall is shared between government and private industry. But then I would say take money and earmark it for, you know, a $1,000 rebate for everyone who buys a car that gets 40 miles to the gallon. So I'm trying to address both sides there. I'm trying to make sure supplies are adequate, but that we're reining in demand at the same time.
And I know you write the R-squared column over at Consumer Energy Report. Is there a particular news story you would like to tell us about?
The latest one I've written about is about subsidies, because in the U.S. that's a real political hot topic. And what I have pointed out is many times people don't really realize what these subsidies consist of. And I've given an example where some of the loudest voices against getting rid of subsidies support low-income heating oil assistance. That is classified as an oil subsidy. The OECD has put together a list where they put together supports for fossil fuel, and that is listed as an oil subsidy. So the same people who are screaming we have to get rid of these subsidies support that program. Farmers who get a fuel tax exemption on the basis that they're not out using the roads and the fuel taxes pay for the roads, they get a fuel tax exemption. That was the second largest category of oil subsidies. So, you know, people have an impression that these subsidies are cash payments to oil companies, when in fact many times they're supporting, like the farmers certainly don't want to get rid of that fuel tax exemption, and at the same time they would say we don't support oil subsidies. So people don't really understand what they are. And that was my point, is we need to, if we're going to have an intelligent discussion about this, people really need to understand what they are, what their purpose is, and what the impact of getting rid of them would be.
Well, now, as my last question, I want to say that some of my listeners are really nervous that the economy could stall or even crash because we didn't adapt to declining energy. How serious do you think our situation is?
I think that, you know, the problem is, you know, we still have this growing demand from all the developing countries. And as we emerge from recession, always our demand for oil goes up. And what happens when demand for oil goes up is the price goes up and can put us back into recession. So I actually talk about this in the book. I call the scenario after Jim Kunstler's The Long Emergency, I call it the long recession. It's the recession that every time you try to emerge from, you go back into recession because you've driven oil prices up. And that is only going to happen when we don't have the ability to grow our oil supplies further. And we may be at that point. And so it is very serious. If we don't transition away from oil quickly enough, we will be in this never-ending cycle of recession simply because demand will continue to grow every time we come out.
Well, I like your point of view there. We've been talking with Robert Rapier. He's a chemical engineer employed by America International. Robert is a prolific energy commentator on the net and in mainstream media. His new book is Power Plays, Energy Options in the Age of Peak Oil. Robert, thank you so much for sharing time with us.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Seth Moser-Katz.
And Justin Ritchie from The X-Ray Environmentalist. And today, we're speaking with Michael McGonigal for Radio EcoShock. Michael McGonigal, you are a political economist, environmental lawyer, professor at University of Victoria, and one of the co-founders of Greenpeace International. And today we're here to talk about your ideas on where the environmental movement has been and where it's going. Business as usual has been pushing forward, and it's been trying to return the economies of Europe and the world to the usual form of economic growth that we've been seeing for the last few decades. So what hope do the activists of today have for changing the system that we live in, and what kind of issues should they be focusing on?
That's an interesting question on a whole bunch of levels, but one of the things that I dislike, quite honestly, is the word hope. And there's a very good discussion about that by Derek Jensen in his book Endgame, where he talks about hope is a bad word. It's kind of a con job because, you know, well, we can't really make any difference, but we can always hope. And his thing is, and I agree with this, there is no hope. The machine is cranking on, but who cares? So we just do what we can do. And we can enjoy doing what we can do. We can celebrate life in the process. So I would say that for the activists of today, the hope of turning this machine around is essentially non-existent and will require serious shocks to that system for changes to take place. But I don't think that really matters in that, I mean, it's frustrating, of course, but in that we just have to do what has to be done and understand what has to be done. And another problem with the word hope is that so much of what people do is tailored to being realistic, to being acceptable, not to step out of line, not to use terms like capitalism or growth. God forbid to use terms like that in a critical way because, oh, you get discredited. So from that, the number one things activists, I think, have to do is to understand really well and work really hard to understand the dynamics of the systems that we have on this planet and to bring those out into the public consciousness and to talk about them and to put forward ideas which really go to the core of the crisis of capital, the crisis of the state and state regulation that we all need to start looking at, because there's huge possibilities. I mean, in terms of changing the system, if we decided to, oh my gosh, there's millions of things we could do, but we can't do that because we don't understand it. We don't see it. We kind of naturalize it. So the number one thing I would say that environmentalists need to do is to denaturalize capitalism, denaturalize the state system, the regulatory system, the way we think, and say these are constructed and take them apart and actually renaturalize. Say then what are the things that we need to start with? What are the fundamentals we need to get back to?
You started off with a really bold statement that you don't feel that hope is something that people should be relying on. Can you take us back to when you started becoming an activist, maybe in the 60s and 70s, what was it like back then and what has changed from then to now?
Well, you know, David Suzuki, Canada's famous environmentalist, a couple of weeks ago was quoted in the paper as having said that environmentalism has basically been wasting its time for the last 20 years because we shouldn't have been talking about environmental stuff. We should have been talking about growth. And I agree with that. Back in the 1960s and 1970s, I was stupid back in those days. I thought I knew something, but really I was just obsessed about killing whales and how terrible it was, and we had to stop that. And I was not really that aware of the dynamics of capital and so on, which is what drives the whole process. So in those days, it was really very issue specific. In my part of the world, in BC, where I was in Vancouver, it was, you know, Greenpeace issues. Their big concern was BC Hydro because it was building all these dams. No one was even concerned in the least about forestry, which then became, of course, the big issue in Canada. It was naively optimistic, and it was a simpler time, in fact. I don't think even the industrialized power structures were aware that we couldn't have both our economic growth machine and environmental quality. I mean, the whole movement of environmentalism in the States in the 60s, Nixon was behind a lot of the great legislation that went through in the late 60s and 70s in the United States, and they thought we could have it all. We could have clean water and clean air and healthy forests, and all we need to do is better regulation, more efficiency, and so on. So it was kind of a naive time, and I was certainly a part of that. I just thought we can stop it. I mean, and we were successfully in Greenpeace, and that's what I was doing in the 70s and 80s. I was fighting the whaling industry, and we won, quote unquote. We got a global moratorium back in 1982. 30 years later, they're still whaling, and there's still way worse pressure on the oceans. So we were fighting specific issues and thinking we were winning, but we weren't.
So what you're saying is that environmentalists traditionally have not questioned the economic rationale of the day, and that's what's really changing?
I wouldn't say it's changing. I don't think environmentalists are still challenging the question of the economic rationale, and we can come back to that. If you look at, say, the left, the movements, the arguments of the left in the 1950s and 60s, it had no environmental component to it whatsoever. Environmentalism was seen as bourgeois, middle class, NIMBYism, right? We like to have a nice clean environment where we live, and we'll just, you know, regulate or push it somewhere else. And so the left had no recognition of the importance of nature, particularly for the economic system. Similarly, environmentalists had no real appreciation for the critical understanding of the economic dynamics that were driving environmental problems. So neither side was really engaging with the other. And to a degree, I think that's still pretty true. I mean, the left has been more sensitive to environmental issues than in the past, but they're still seen as environmental issues. They're not really understood as deeply on the left as they should be. Meanwhile, I think that's why I talk about exit environmentalism. I think environmentalists still don't understand that. They don't ever look at where wealth comes from.
So maybe you could go a little bit more into the concept of exit environmentalism.
The concept is two things. We got to leave behind the past. We got to exit the old environmentalism. We got to leave that behind, which is what I call liberal environmentalism. And we've got to move into a new environmentalism, which takes us out of that system, which exits that system. We exit the old environmentalism, and the new environmentalism helps us exit the liberal system. And just to give a very simple explanation of it, I teach in the law school at the University of Victoria, and I've taught environmental law. I've done environmental activism and forest policy and forest regulation, international law, environmental law, et cetera, for decades. But the reality is all of those laws, all of these regulations require the state. And basically, you can put environmentalism and environmental law in the same category, because almost every environmental battle really wants new legislation or to take government subsidies or whatever. So it all requires action by the state. But the biggest developer around is the state. It's not Exxon. It's not Bechtel or Toyota or General Motors. It's the state. In Canada, it's the state that's driving oil production out of the tar sands in Alberta and subsidizing it. It's the state that licenses all these large timber tenures and subsidizes fisheries everywhere and builds highways and bails out car companies. It's the state, the state, the state. So what we can achieve through environmentalism and through environmental law is minimal, because the state depends upon development. It depends upon environmental development. So the left has long criticized capitalism, which should be done, but we got to go beyond that. It's not just capitalism, it's the state itself, which is very dependent on capitalism and dependent upon economic growth, and therefore sees its own physical base as being resources to be developed. So exit environmentalism means coming to terms with that, understanding that, and understanding that, oh, we can make incremental things and we got to be realistic, but we're never going to get very far. We're going to be slipping further and further behind, even with our little victories, unless we address the real fundamental dynamics of environmental erosion. And I teach a class and have this kind of approach to law I call green legal theory, which addresses that beyond environmental law. It's a big, big challenge. And it's a big challenge intellectually to see beyond the kind of naturalized world we take for granted, that these are just the systems we have. It's a big challenge there. It's a big challenge historically in terms of the roots of these problems. And they're not 20 or 50 years old. They go way back. And we're talking really the West and the compulsions of the West. And you can go back to the ancient Greeks if you want, and very fundamental problems. So the solutions aren't ones you can just kind of figure out pretty easily, because they are so deeply rooted. And that's a problem. That's why I think it's a problem of discourse and debate. As I say to people, you know, we're running around actively, urgently trying to save things and take action. And that's not what we need to do. We need actually to stop. We need to slow down. We need to look at where the problems are coming from and how we understand those. So the metaphor I've been using recently is, it's like going to England's, right? And running across the road. And before you cross the road, you look to the left, as we do here, and we run out into the road and we get run over, because cars in England come from the right. So we have to realize that actually we've got to re-educate how we think, and not just look to the right when you cross the street, but get it so ingrained in our body that we automatically look to the right, and then we can survive. We have to do that same sort of thing here. We have to understand that the environmental problems are not specific environmental problems that can be solved by regulation and specific looking at focusing just on specific problems. We have to re-educate ourselves to think about what's behind those problems and automatically see those dynamics behind the problems and address those, not the problems themselves.
You are tuned to a special interview for Radio EcoShock by the extra-environmentalists Seth Moser-Katz and Justin Ritchie. Our guest is Professor Michael McGonigal, formerly with Greenpeace International, then chair of Greenpeace Canada, a teacher of environmental law at the University of Victoria. Back to Seth and Michael.
As individuals, we're so involved in our governments. We're so involved in these systems and these large-scale institutions that have been, you know, passed down to us from generation to generation. You mentioned the Romans. That's a very, very long time ago. And that kind of mentality has been with humanity for generations and generations. How is it that humans can step past these kind of ingrained ways of thinking, these cultural identities, identifying with one country or one race? How do we see past these kind of large scale problems that are just so fundamentally a part of what it is to be human right now? Is there a way that we can do that without destroying the whole entire culture? Is there a way to pick up the pieces from what we have now and construct something that's constructive and will be able to be sustainable in the future?
I don't know. And you asked me first if there's hope. And given the depth of the problems, I would say the answer is no, that there isn't hope. That the only way that these changes ultimately will be resolved is through responding to a lot of catastrophic changes. And these are not ones I'm making up, right? I mean, climate change is one of the most obvious, but biodiversity loss is another one. Huge impacts. And again, this goes with some of the economic problems we're seeing today in the chaos that's happening there. It's a daunting thing. And as a result, people will say, oh, I don't want to talk about that. That's just so depressing. I want to be an optimist. So let's not talk about it. And that itself is a problem because we don't want to confront these things because they make people depressed. But actually, I don't think we need to think about it that way, because there are so many different ways of living that can get us, move us there. So, for example, one of the long historical problems that underpins the environmental crisis is the enclosure movement, where beginning, say, in England in the 1300s, but then really taking off later on, those communal, feudal-based structures that protected local communities who then could manage their own commons, their own fields collectively through their own rules, not through the crown or the king or the central government, but themselves. Those people were kicked off the land. They were enclosed. Their lands were enclosed and turned into private ownership so that they could be exploited as commodities for trade internationally and for industrialization and so on. That's a huge, long process. That process is also called colonialism, imperialism, where native people were again enclosed, pushed off their lands, stuck on reservations so that the state could get access to those lands. That's a process that's gone on for hundreds of years, several hundreds of years. Well, local activism is anti-enclosure. One of the things that we can be doing right now is understanding the nature of enclosure. And the Occupy movement is a very good counterexample to enclosure, saying the space, we have to look at the spaces of capital. We have to look at how things are played out and to reclaim those spaces. Very difficult to do. These spaces are now being colonized by iPhones, where people are walking down the street and don't even realize that they live in a space because they're all clicking away on their iPhones. The momentum of the colonization of space continues. But the resistance to that is also very direct. Whether it's the Occupy movement or native rights, indigenous people throughout the world, the World Social Forum, or these are being put forward, or all kinds of, you know, movements to reclaim the commons or counter alternative currencies and so on. But these things have to be understood not as kind of nice things that are done on their own, but as important, because they're going at the fundamental roots of the dynamics of central power, and that they're significant in that way. They're going to not easily be achieved. I mean, you see that, for example, the history of indigenous rights in Canada, continuous co-option. So it's that sort of understanding translating into very specific actions, including in my own town, for example, in Victoria, there's an area called Fernwood, where a lot of university students live in kind of a neat neighborhood. And they're actually trying to take that old neighborhood and turn it into one big farm where different people are growing different stuff in their backyards and creating a herbal apothecary where they distribute herbal medicines and so on from there. I mean, it's that type of reclamation which has deep roots, and you can take action and love doing it because it's such a neat thing to be doing, working in your own community doing that, but also knowing you're doing it in response to hundreds and hundreds of years of colonialism, which have to be countered if we're going to survive.
starting with reclaiming space seems like a tangible step, something that I can do, but I see some barriers to that. One, definitely the elites and the way that they have lashed out against the Occupy movement, you know, just simply people getting together and talking has seen tremendous crackdowns, not just in North America, but around the world. And then also other people who might minimize it and say, oh, you know, there's so many big problems in the world and you're just going out and gardening in your community and gardening with other people. How is that really going to address the bigger problems? What would you say to both of those issues?
Both of those issues, I would say the answer is the same. We have to talk about it. We have to understand what the problems are. And I think there's a level of, and maybe I'm sounding too much like an academic, but I'm an activist, and I see it in both ways, in both places. There's a desperate need for deeper understandings about the dynamics of the systems that are driving us. And there's a blockage to people wanting to talk about that. The Occupy movement, I think, was a brilliant set of strategies last year and into the spring, because it so disrupted the consciousness of the elites and at the same time got a lot of public support from people, and disrupted the consciousness because it did things that didn't fit. And it didn't fit because, and it's so sophisticated. I mean, for example, well, just tell us what you want was one of the responses. Tell us your demands. And the response is, we don't have any demands. We don't want to put forward demands. And that's just, well, that doesn't make sense. Well, of course it makes sense if you think that the problem is who the demands would be made to. It would be made to the political power structure. Well, the political power structure is itself the problem. And, you know, there's been a lot of discussion in the last 20 years about rights, the weakness of rights, environmental rights, or women's rights, because rights themselves are granted by the systems that themselves are problematic. So the Occupy movement, by refusing to make demands, kind of disoriented the system, people's understandings, in a very sophisticated and powerful way. Capitalism was talked about a lot in the Occupy movement. The nature of inequity, the profound inequities were talked about in ways that haven't been done before. I think there is a possibility of opening up this dialogue, a broader dialogue with elites, but it can't be one that people shrink back from. People have to be very clear of what's going on, for example, in Montreal right now with these demonstrations against tuition fee increases in Quebec. And people don't realize why students are so entrenched about that, because it's a social democratic tradition that's being challenged by making university less and less accessible to people in comparison with, say, Scandinavian countries where tuition is often free because they want it to be accessible to everybody. These battles are not going to be won easily. They're going to have to be won through a lot of clarity, a lot of strength against co-opting forces, but particularly through dialogue, through putting forward over and over again very strong explanations and clear explanations as to the dynamics that we take for granted and why they're not working anymore.
As one of the co-founders of Greenpeace, you have an interesting perspective on the Occupy movement. You mentioned that they don't really have a lot of demands. Is this the next sort of step in organizational dynamic, is not really having a demand to say, we want to stop this pipeline or we want to stop killing these whales? It's just to kind of take yourself out of the system and express dissatisfaction with the whole system in general. Is this the next step in what people need to be doing?
I don't think there's any one strategy. I think that, I mean, blocking pipelines to the West Coast to prevent the delivery of oil from the tar sands to China is absolutely imperative. I think it's a really good thing to be doing. But the argument that has to be made there is not just we don't want oil tankers on the coast because those oil tankers are going to eventually have an accident and cause damage. Sure, spent years fighting oil tankers, part of my work for like 10 years. So I totally relate to that, and I know the damage they can do. You can make those arguments, but the deeper arguments need to be made, such as that we should be leaving this stuff in the ground. To the extent that we are continuing to dig up and look for more sources of fuel of any type, whether it's wind energy or tidal power or biofuels or tar sands, we're just extending the system. What we need to do is to run out of energy. We need to slow down our demands. We need to reduce our demands. One of the absolute most important criteria for an exit environmentalism is what's called demand reduction, not new supplies, reducing demand. Capitalism can't handle that. So we ought to not just talk about oil causing environmental problems, but that we need to reduce the use of oil, we need to reduce the use of fossil fuels, we need to reduce energy, period, because they all have unacceptable costs. Well, when we do that, we confront the reality that we need more energy if we're going to grow, because capital needs to grow. Well, then we've got to talk about the growth dynamic of capitalism. And then we've got to talk about, well, and the state is addicted to that. So the problem with blocking the Enbridge pipeline is, one, about needing to have a different form of economics, a post-capitalist economics, and a different form of government, which, unlike the state, which is completely addicted to economic growth. And unless we do that, that pipeline is going to happen because the growth system needs it. So what's the alternative to that? Well, for example, what about indigenous people all along the pipeline having a veto? So maybe local communities, we need a new constitutional arrangement where local communities can veto assaults on their landscape and can say, no, we don't want that. So that's the discourse that needs to change, not necessarily the actions. And actions like the Occupy movement were great because they went to the heart of financial capital. They went to Wall Street. They started in Wall Street and they refused to move and they wanted to talk. They didn't mount demands. They wanted to talk about the problems. And that's what's needed. So yes, it's a new form of environmentalism, but it's a new form of environmentalism that's tied to the old forms of environmentalism, but transform it. Pull us out of a liberal environmentalism that thinks, oh, if we just have better environmental assessment processes, we have good decision making. No, ain't going
to
work.
So it's about saying we want to leave that oil in the ground because we want our economic system to either fail or develop a new economic system that's better?
We want to leave that oil in the ground because pumping out more oil from the ground is just going to exacerbate climate change, because it will just increase supply when the economic problems we have is a supply-driven economy. And we need to be able to develop new forms of economy which do not require that sort of supply. I'll give you a very specific example. Why don't we get rid of the automobile? Let's just get rid of the automobile. If we got rid of the automobile, or at least for 99% of its uses, we would have different forms of transportation, bicycles, for example. We would have different patterns of urban development, urban organizations. We'd have more public transit. We'd have more equity. People would not have to spend, as they do today, $10,000 per year to maintain an automobile. $10,000 per year, which sounds ridiculous, but you put the price of a car in, say a car costs $20,000, you have it for 10 years, there's $2,000, but people buy them on credit, so now you got to pay your interest payments, you've got to pay gasoline, you've got to pay maintenance, you've got to pay insurance, you've got to pay parking. People spend on average $10,000 a year for cars. Okay, so we don't want oil because oil is going to drive climate change. So we're going to reduce our use of energy. We reduce our use of energy, we need to come up with other forms of transportation. So let's get rid of the automobile. Well, we get rid of the automobile, we got better cities. People don't waste money on these cars that are just propping up an old system. We have a healthier population because people get around by bicycle. We have whole different infrastructure for people who use bikes and so on and so forth. We begin the change. We begin the change we need to make. It's not such a big deal. The problem is, why do we need cars? Well, look at China. The last 10 years, China's gone from being a bicycle-based society to being the biggest purchaser of automobiles in the world. 1.4 billion people all want cars. If that isn't stupid, I don't know what is. Why are they doing that? Because they've bought into the Western model of development. Big capital investments needed. How is China going to get capital investments? The only way China's going to get capital investment in from the West is playing the West game. So rather than leapfrogging past the Western industrial capitalist system, it's bought into it. And it's going to cause massive problems, as we all know, with coal and so on. And it's not meeting the needs of its own people. I have a Chinese student, graduate student here, who says that every 5 minutes in China, a new violent protest erupts. Every 5 minutes. It's not meeting the needs of its people. It's not meeting economic needs. It's crazy. We need to talk about that. People can see it. They feel it in their gut. But we need to justify our actions and explain our actions in light of those types of systemic understandings. We don't do that. We just say we don't want a pipeline because it's going to break up and cause damage on the coast of BC.
Thanks for joining us today, Michael, to talk about exit environmentalism on Radio EcoShock.
This is just the first part of our interview with Michael McGonigal. For more episodes and for the full version of this episode, come check out our website at www.extraenvironmentalist.com.
I first heard Michael McGonigal's talk on exit environmentalism in a badly recorded YouTube speech at the University of Victoria. It seemed too important to waste. Seth Moser-Katz and Justin Ritchie volunteered to do this interview for Radio EcoShock as part of their longer podcast called The Extra Environmentalist. Just Google that or go to extraenvironmentalist.com. That's an irregular podcast which takes the time, sometimes up to 2 hours, to talk in depth with some of the new edges of green. We have time for just a quick sample from another Extra Environmentalist podcast that I enjoyed so much, Dr. Michael Huseman, author of the book Technofix. That is episode number 37. Find a link in my blog at ecoshock.info. The Technofix podcast runs 1 hour 54 minutes, and I've sliced out a couple of samples running less than 10 minutes. It's definitely just a scratch of the surface, a teaser to encourage you to hear the whole thing.
Welcome to the Extra Environmentalist.
Your opposable thumb
means nothing.
This is what we want to be. We don't want to be Americans or Germans or English. We want to be extra environmentalists. Always feel wherever you go that you are a stranger, the outsider, the one looking in. This is the viewpoint that makes all places the same to you.
Hello and welcome to The Extra Environmentalist. I'm your host, Seth Moser-Katz, along with my co-host, Justin Ritchie. And today is an amazing day, isn't it, Justin?
Today is an incredible day. We are here speaking with Michael Huseman, and I know I'm mispronouncing his name, so I apologize to him and anyone who can actually pronounce his name properly. And we're speaking with him about his book that he co-wrote with his wife, Technofix, which is the definitive book about technology and all the misconceptions that fuel our modern notion of techno-optimism.
We have techno-optimism, especially in developed countries like the United States. I follow the techno-optimism blogs very closely, and I consider myself a techno-optimist extraordinaire.
Dr. Michael Huseman, thanks for joining us from Arizona today. You're a research scientist with a special interest in sustainability and critical science. You've specialized in environmental biotechnology for more than 25 years, and we're here today to talk about your recent book, Technofix.
Yeah, it's nice to be here.
So, Michael, after a career in developing technology, what prompted you to start writing Technofix in the first place?
Yeah, I come from a rather long family tradition of science and engineering. My great-grandfather had a PhD in chemistry, and both my father and my grandfather both were mechanical engineers. So when I grew up, there was no question what my profession should be. I should clearly study engineering. And so my motivation early on when I was even a teenager was, oh, I want to study engineering to help society, to help the environment. And so I picked chemical engineering and went off to college. But after I got my PhD in chemical engineering, I joined a very large multinational company, and I was somewhat naive. I joined them in the environmental research department, and I thought, oh, they're going to use environmental research to clean up the environment, to help the environment. And I was, as I mentioned, a little bit naive. They really use the environmental research to change regulations, to make regulations, environmental regulations, more lenient. And so at some point it actually came to a clash between me and management. I defended my research plans, my experimental design in front of all these managers, and said, well, this is the best design because it's unbiased and objective. They said, we are not really interested in this. We would like you to change this to get better results at the end. And I said, well, I can't do it. I want to do unbiased research. And then one manager told me, well, Michael, you are not hired here to do science. You can do science on the weekend. And so I left that company. And soon afterwards, however, I realized that even with supposedly unbiased research. When I looked through many, I must have read thousands of research papers and also research proposals in the environmental area. And also, most of that research was unbiased and objective. I sort of felt that most of the research actually was not really helping that environment that much. There was not much implementation of these ideas to protect and help the environment. And so I got more and more frustrated with this lack of progress. And so I started thinking about what's going on here with science and technology. Can science and technology really help the environment? Can it really solve the problems of society? And so it took me really to study this question for 15 years. This is not just a short project. And at some point in the middle of this project, my wife Joyce joined me, and she has a doctorate in statistics and a master's degree in anthropology. And so she could make an interesting contribution to this project because of her cross-cultural perspectives from this anthropological background. So it became a very interesting project for many years. And as a result of our long collaborative research, we believe that Technofix is one of the most comprehensive and thought-provoking critiques of modern science and technology.
What is it like working with your wife so closely on such intricate projects?
Well, it is interesting because it results in rather intense discussions over breakfast and lunch and dinner. You know, it's very interesting, but of course it results also sometimes in conflicts in terms of conflicting viewpoints, but it results in a more interesting overall perspective at the end of the process. So we wrote different parts of the books and then edited each other's part. So there was also some cross-fertilization at that level. So that was interesting.
In taking the title Technofix, can you tell us why you chose that title and why technology won't save us?
A technofix is basically an attempt to solve a problem with technology by addressing only the symptoms instead of the root cause. And it's called a fix because it does not really result in long-term lasting solutions. So technofixes are attempts to solve either problems caused by previous technologies or to solve social problems. Let me give you a few examples about solving problems caused by previous technologies. Two examples. One is traffic congestion. Traffic congestion, the root cause of traffic congestion, of course, is too many cars, too many drivers, too many miles driven. And the technofix is to build more roads. And, you know, there's always this idea, if we build more roads, traffic congestion will disappear. But it has been known for over 100 years that building more roads attracts more traffic, so it makes the problem worse. So that's a good example of a technofix. Now, we have a whole other series of technofixes appearing here on the horizon for climate change mitigation technologies. Now, climate change is primarily caused, as everyone knows, by fossil fuel combustion, CO2 emissions related to fossil fuel combustion. So scientists start thinking about how to get rid of this excess CO2. So there are these concepts of pumping the CO2 into the ground called geological carbon sequestration. The problem with this is we don't know whether it will stay in the ground, whether it will leak out. And then when it leaks out, the CO2 leaks out of the ground, whether it will have health or environmental impact. Then other scientists have come up with the concept of pumping the CO2, the excess CO2, into the deep ocean. But then we don't know what happens to the pH, whether the ocean will acidify, and what will happen to the deep sea creatures. And then even another idea is to sprinkle a little fertilizer over hundreds of square miles of ocean to stimulate phytoplankton growth. Because as soon as phytoplankton, algae, start growing, then they suck out CO2 from the air to grow, like, you know, any plant does during photosynthesis. But the question there is, again, what will happen if you have all these algae blooms all over the ocean? What will happen to the food web, the whole nutrient cycles, etc.? So you can see that technofixes have three problems. The first thing is they always have unanticipated side effects. And the second problem is they are never really providing long-term lasting solutions because they never address the root cause of the problem. And then the third problem with fixes is they cover up symptoms and often make problems worse. And so that's why technofixes are a bad idea.
That was a sample from the Extra Environmentalist, podcast number 37, Technofix, with Dr. Michael Huseman. He recorded it in a stone-lined room in the U.S. Southwest, which accounts for the strange echo. Get the whole thing at extraenvironmentalist.com. Still wondering what to think? If it's safe or cool to hope? Me too. We'll have more dialogue on the way forward in coming Radio EcoShock shows, plus news about the three crises, climate change, the energy crisis, and the fragile economy. Keep tuned to Radio EcoShock at our website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening.